I think there is a problem with this passage. It is my favorite in the Gospel of Mark. And it comes up every single year. So I often have more words than less words for this passage. And on this Sunday, I even renamed this not a sermon, but a reflection to try to keep myself short and brief and to the point. I'd like to start with a contemporary reading, a poem by Mary Oliver entitled One. The mosquito is so small, it takes almost nothing to ruin it. Each leaf the same, and the black ant hurrying. So many lives and so many fortunes. Every morning I walk softly and with forward glances down to the ponds and through the pine woods. Mushrooms even have their but a brief hour before the slug creeps to the feast, before the pine needles hustle down under the bundles of harsh, beneficent rain. How many make up a world? And then I think of that old idea, the singular and the eternal, one cup in which everything is swirled back to the color of the sea and sky. Imagine it, a shining cup, surely. In the moment in which there is no wind over your shoulder, you stare down into it, and there you are, your own darling face, your own eyes. And then the wind, not thinking of you, just passes by, touching the ant, the mosquito, the leaf, and you know what else? How blue is the sea, how blue is the sky, how blue and tiny and redeemable everything is, even you, even your eyes, even your imagination. The Transfiguration story in Mark is told in a very straightforward way. Jesus takes his three closest disciples up a mountain one day, and we know that they're his closest disciples because he's given them nicknames. Simon he calls Peter, meaning rock, like the rock, like you see in movies, only kind of, because it actually means kind of like a little rock, like somewhere in between a pebble and a stone. And James and John, the sons of thunder, Boanerges, the sons of Boanerges. And we don't know exactly what this term, sons of thunder, means, but we often applied it, at least in some Pentecostal traditions, to very outspoken preachers, people who can really rile up a crowd. At the top of this mountain, Jesus is changed in front of them, and the text says transfigured. It's not a word that we use very often or ever. I don't know if I've ever used it outside of these four walls. But you can imagine that it means something like what a caterpillar does as it becomes a butterfly, or what those bulbs we put in, those ugly brown bulbs we put in the ground, how they each come back every year and become really pretty lilies. You know, those are this kind of natural way of thinking about how beauty is transfigured in front of us. And there he meets up with two prophets of Israel's storied history, Moses and Elijah, and they're conversing. And this is quite a sight, apparently, because the sons of thunder are silent. And Peter kind of mumbles something about building some tents. And this cloud forms and says, "This is my son, my beloved. Listen to him." And then the lights go out. They descend the mountain, and Jesus tells them not to tell anyone else just yet. I think that this is like a super weird story, and we need to treat it first and foremost as a really weird story. Not only for us who are living 2,000 years beyond when this story was written But even for the original hearers of this story, transfigurations were not common in those days either. And to hear this story must have had many people question, well, what's the point of all this? After all, it feels like for many of us, we turn to our religious traditions because we want some foundation for a world that can sometimes feel shaky. We turn to religion for support or comfort during times of trial. We turn to religion for celebrations of new babies coupling and things of that nature. We want certainty out of our religion. We want comfort out of our religion. And perhaps for these reasons, this story is often neglected, even though we are supposed to read it every single Sunday before Lent starts. But I think that there is an incredible story here. I want you to think about a moment where you felt complete and utterless awe. When were you so taken back that you were like the sons of thunder? You could not say a single word. What was an experience when you were like Simon Peter and you just started mumbling a bunch of words together and because you had no idea what to do with that experience? Who was there in that experience? Where were you in that experience? Now, I admit I'm someone who is easily awed, but I had the chance to go to the Grand Canyon in January and felt like that was a completely different experience. It seemed like what I could see was bigger than my field of vision, and what was there was bigger than my imagination. And it was wonderful to be there with people that I thoroughly loved and enjoyed their company. That was an experience for me. And I think I said, wow, more in those 2 days than I've said wow in my entire life. And when I think back of that experience, I still think of that word, wow. I mean, like, I have a hard time describing what that meant. Likely, we've all had similar experiences. They're with people, they're in places that are important to us now. And we don't need to necessarily define why we feel that way. We don't have to parse out the details of these experiences to know that they had a profound impact in our lives, a profound impact in our ability to be stretched as human beings, a profound impact in how we live our lives today. Vincent van Gogh once said, for my part, I know nothing with any certainty, but the sight of the stars make me dream. And I wonder if we sometimes box our faith in a little bit, that it exists here on Sundays or here from 10 to 11 or in a Bible study, or in the prayers we say when we say prayers. But I think this transfiguration experience causes us to question that boxing mentality. To imagine that how we experience our faith is but a part of what God is doing in this world. And I think about Peter's words here, that he wants to build these tents up on the mountain or shrines, places where we can go to experience Jesus and Elijah and Moses once again. And that's very convenient for us because we can go on our pilgrimages to these holy sites, see these figures that are important to us, then walk back to our daily lives. But in the story of the Transfiguration, perhaps we're getting this story in which the presence of God is actually all around. It's here on earth. It is within our midst. And it is so much bigger than we could imagine. That faith is more than comfort in times of distress, or a moral compass, or the possibility of healing, that our faith is more than a prophetic word, a faithful charity, or the bearer of all things sacred, that our faith is more than just a call to justice or a way to fight for the oppressed or an invitation to love. Because perhaps our still speaking faith continues to find new expressions, encompassing all of those things, and yet has more to say. I think there is a little bit part in this passage that deals with good stewardship. And I'm not talking about the stewardship that we mention in churches a lot, about how we support the faith community with our time and talent and treasures, but about how we can be good stewards to all that is around us. Because good stewardship deals with caretaking and minding. It's something that we do in our families, in our homes, and in our communities. It's used an awful lot in the environmental movement, ecological stewardship. One aspect of good stewardship is to resist hoarding or the stockpiling up of more than what we need or what others might need. And this is our caution from Peter. The caution we've actually had 2 weeks in a row, because last week Jesus is healing folks in Capernaum, and then the next day he goes off to a mountain to recharge his batteries, and Peter goes out and looks for him, hoping to bring him back to Capernaum so that he can be their local physician, so that he can be the family doctor. But Jesus resists this notion and tells Peter that he must travel around and go to other places, because his work is bigger than being the family physician. A shrine, a place set apart as holy, a place one can visit from time to time, is not a part of everyday life. Again, Jesus, or the cloud in this story, or the silence of them walking down this mountain, causes us to think that Jesus resists this notion once again. The work of God in this world wants to resist our need to categorize it or contain it. It resists our need to locate it on a map or leave it there. Our story should cause us to wonder what shrines we have erected throughout the centuries to bottle our faith, to clearly set up our boundaries. Because of faith that is bigger than our imaginations, present in all things and in all times, is what we actually need. One that works in ways that we have yet to consider. And this can be scary, and it can be demanding to imagine such a big faith. So my prayer for us this morning is that we resist the desire to bottle our faith, and instead allow ourselves to imagine what's possible with a God that never ceases to bring the all. Amen.